are back, everybody, and it has been a light week on the obits, but or a light couple of weeks, but two giants left us, one of them just recently, great Alan Arkin. Let's talk about Alan Arkin first, Tim.
I have no idea why that was still so ludicrously surprising to me. Why that was just, and it popped up on my feed like about 4 minutes after they like report 4 minutes, and yeah. I was like, Alan Arkin, they got Alan Arkin, and so that series that he was in with Michael Douglas,
The Comiskey Method.
And, the last few arcs of that series, I don't want to completely ruin it for anybody. You know, there's an interesting storyline there. And I don't know why, but that came roaring back to me. And I was like, man, that was so prescient. And for whatever reason, he was just one of those guys who was very present. He was never out of the picture. He wasn't one of those guys where you went away for 25 years and then you heard he died.
Yeah.
You know? No, he was just on the show right over there. You know, get nominated for an Emmy or whatever the hell it is. And so he was just so it was just extremely surprising for whatever reason. And you know, look, I could go on forever about Alan Arkin. And all of the great stuff. Bridget, my lovely wife, she loved Waiting Till Dark in particular.
So good. So uncharacteristic of him.
You know, playing that guy. That, and I don't know. I can. It's almost impossible, right, to really sort of work your way back through all of the stuff of Alan Arkin and figure out, you know, what's the Alan Arkin that you love the most.
He played Inspector Clouseau at one point, Shot in the Dark. Everybody forgets that, you know, he stepped in there for a minute when Peter Sellers wasn't there. I mean, it's kind of an amazing, and he did a great job. And, you know, Catch 22, and obviously, you know, Little Miss Sunshine, he won his Oscar. I always think of, there are two films that stand out for me. One is The In-Laws.
Yes.
Where he and Peter Falk are just tearing it up. And yeah. I know a good deal about that because, you know, Richard Libertini, very dear friend of mine and my family, the late Richard Libertini plays the South American dictator in that ridiculous South American dictator. And he plays it broad. And it's kind of a descending scale of comedy. Richard is just broad as can be with his little, you know, Senor Wences thing with the hand and the paintings and all the stuff. He's really broad. And then Peter Falk is, you know, still a little hot, but he's not that hot. And Alan Arkin has to be straight man to the both of them.
Yeah.
And I remember Richard just could not. It's one of the great experiences of his acting career was to be able to try to make those two break character and laugh. when they were shooting, and man, Arkin just brought it. He was just stone cold in character, and it was, you know, he earned everyone's trust. And my other one, not a good movie, America's Sweethearts, not a good movie. Huh? Alan Arkin is in it for a brief cameo. He's got like two scenes, but he's hysterical because he's a guru in it. And he's got that long hair, and he's got two really hilarious moments where he says to John Cusack, he goes, "There's a very old saying, Alaham alaikum alaikum," and John Cusack goes, "Well, what does that mean?" And he goes, "I don't know, but it's very old." And, I mean, hilarious. And then when Billy Crystal says to him about John Cusack, he goes, "He's going to be okay, right?" And Alan Arkin's standing there, he's holding like a fern twig, and he just sniffs it, and he says, "Life is a cookie." And it's just so ridiculous, but it's so funny. And he just owns it.
He's just, and all that, and, but then you come forward, you know, 20, I guess it would be about 20 years from that to the early 90s, and he's like this anchor in like Glenn Ross, this very sort of, and he has a lot of those, you know, where that whole range is right there in Alan Arkin. Although you really can't say though that Alan Arkin ever just sort of like played Alan Arkin. He was he played characters. He played people. You know,
effortlessly. It was just it's amazing. Now I'm going to miss him, but he left a legacy, a real legacy. And then Glenda Jackson, the amazing Glenda Jackson. You know, speaking of Richard Libertini, his late wife Melinda Dillon was part of that same class of actresses in the 1970s. They all came out of theater. and they just came storming into the movies. And, you know, it was a new class of actresses, and it was, you know, it was Marsha Mason, and it was Melinda, and it was
Jill Clayburgh and a few others. And
Jill Clayburgh and Diane Keaton, and Glenda Jackson was just like the towering center of all of them. She was amazing. She was just a real presence.
Yeah, along with the, you know, on the male side of that would have been like Hoffman and Gene Hackman and all those guys.
De Niro,
sense of realism, a sort of naturalistic beauty that hadn't sort of been there before, and that was her. Glenda was an MP during the period that Maggie Thatcher was in. I would not happen to be stationed in the UK during that period. And, you know, now we go to all these guys. I worked for this guy, General Rudolph E. Wacker, and we would go to all of these events or whatever. I was this. And I would just see, you're standing behind the general holding his briefcase, doing whatever. And I would see all, and Glenda Jackson would be one who would come. Her and Maggie were on opposite sides, everything on earth. But these two powerful and interesting women all that long ago. And I think it's amazing that she made it back, after she retired from politics or moved out of professional politics anyway, revived her career in theater and a little bit of film and all of that. Bloody Sunday, man. You know, I think of Bloody Jackson, I think of Bloody Sunday. Women in Love, but Bloody Sunday when I think of Glenda Jackson.
No, she just Women in Love, it would be my pick. But boy, I mean, so many wonderful, wonderful performances. It's just... going to miss them both. Going to miss them both. They're really, really great. Let's talk just a little bit about, first of all, there was a little dust up over the fact that the French Connection had some racial epithets censored on its Criterion Collection run, and it's still up there. And some people wrote us and said, hey, what's going on? Is Criterion getting soft? What's the story? And the story appears to be that, you know, everyone has to understand, Criterion doesn't do, like, they license these things. So Criterion will call up Disney and they'll say, hey, could we get we're doing a thing on method acting, and Hoffman is part of it, or Hackman is part of it, and we're doing a little series on method acting, and we'd love to put French Connection in there because it's got, you know, some great history and we got some material on it. Could we do that? And Disney will go, yeah, pay us, you know, X amount of dollars, and Criterion will negotiate and they'll come up with a license fee, and then Disney will deliver them the old master, the 20th Century Fox master that they have of French Connection. And sometimes what they get from a company is amazing, and sometimes it's terrible. Like during their Michelle Yeoh series, they're like Magnificent Warriors. I couldn't believe what a great transfer it was. It was unbelievable. It was phenomenal. And then like Royal Warriors was horrible. It was dreadful. It was like somebody had taken a VHS and transferred it to Super 8 and then, you know, flushed it down the toilet, and it was terrible. So you just never know what they're going to receive from the company they're licensing it from. This isn't Criterion putting their stuff out on disc. If it's their own library, they'll really go to town. But if it's something they're licensing for a series on Criterion Channel, it's different. And for whatever reason, somebody over at Disney got their hands on French Connection and said, well, we're going to have to clean this up for the kids. Apparently. And they got a censored version of it. It's a little bit of an embarrassment, but I don't think it'll happen again.
Yeah, it's terrible. And let me just say, it's bad in a bunch of different ways. So like the thing itself, the censoring of the language, particularly racial epithets and whatever that are in the French Connection. If you do that, then you undermine some of the intention of the film, particularly some of the intention of Ernest Tiedemann.
Yes.
Right.
Who also wrote
Shaft.
Thank you.
So Ernest was there, writing that script, William Friedkin and all that stuff. So you undermine this intention. And one of the intentions of Ernest, the filmmakers, was to communicate what they felt to be the truth of the dynamic between the police and various different communities.
Yes.
They were trying to be realistic. Other films did the same thing at the period, tried to, Serpico. Serpico is another one. So this is intentional. The language is specific for a reason, because what these filmmakers are saying, particularly Ernest, who's black, is These folks talk like this in these places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, the police didn't care for that. This is what's interesting to me. They're censoring this language in 2023. In 1970, whenever this movie came out, the police wanted to censor the language. Yeah. we don't want our cops talking like that. Well, they shouldn't talk like that in bars, mm-hmm. but they do, and you know they do. So it's really a sort of ironic sort of thing. This notion of censoring this film that's trying to speak to a truth of a thing.
We can talk about the books and the Roald Dahl stuff. And I mean, everyone's getting a little bit oversensitive about trying to preserve the commercial value of old material, which they think in an era where they think it might offend somebody. But I think we're kind of going to come back to the center here where people understand that you've got to evaluate these works of art in a context.
Yeah.
I was growing up, I remember watching The French Connection the first time it, you know, aired on TV, heavily censored. Mm-hmm. And my parents were still really iffy about it. Like, it had won Best Picture already, but it's like, do we really want him seeing this? You know, it's mm-hmm. they knew what was going on. And even in that context, it was very clear to me that Popeye Doyle was not supposed to be my role model.
Yeah.
I was not supposed to be sitting there as a little kid going, hey, I like that guy. I want to grow up to be just like him. No, this is a crazy man who takes his police work so seriously that he is willing to compromise the police mm-hmm. work to mm-hmm. get it done. It is a personal obsession to him. It's not about the law. It's about the victory for him. So much so, it was even very clear to me during that car chase, this man is breaking the law and putting every human being in that city at risk just to catch a bad guy. Makes him a bad guy, too.
They want you to feel that. Yes. Doing all of that, they want you to feel all of that, right? So Dirty Harry, Clint over there. We are at a moment in filmmaking, in narrative storytelling, in these sort of dramatic, police procedures or whatever, where the creatives are trying to say something true, or trying to say something true.
It's true.
And they're asking us questions about ourselves, too. Look, I'm not going to do a whole film class here, but in my film class, when I've shown this film, these are the things that I tell my students who do question this. So like, you know, your 19, 20, 20, whatever year old students, when they see this film, they want to know, dude, why? What's up with this film? I'm like, this film is a document of a thing that was true about a dynamic between the police force and communities in 1969, 70, 71, 72.
And what I think, and not to, you know, belabor it too much, but what I think people oftentimes miss about The French Connection was that what it was doing in that moment in 1971 that it won Best Picture. What it was doing in that moment in 1971 was something that cop films as recently as a year or two earlier didn't dare do.
No.
And it was something that was a part already of the very early blaxploitation films. They were trafficking in it because those were the themes that their audience understood.
Mm.
But mainstream films hadn't yet adopted that posture. And The French Connection migrated it in many respects the same way that Easy Rider did. It migrated ideas and attitudes and themes and behaviors from underground films, exploitation films, and brought them into a mainstream audience.
The notion of the anti-hero, I think the term was probably created
somewhere around then.
And what that even is. And by the way, you fast forward again, I guess 50 years to The Wire and to The Shield.
There you go. That's the legacy.
I mean, what are you talking about? Leave the movies alone.
And then update on the strike. I don't know if we have an update on the strike. SAG pushed things into a few weeks, so we'll see where they stand in a week.
How do you feel about that letter that came out right before the SAG delayed, I think, to the 12th?
From the rank and file?
Well, the thousand or so heavy hitters.
Yeah, actually. Basically saying to their leadership, hold the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they're itching to go out on strike. I think they want to join the writers on the line. I think Fran Drescher and the SAG leadership who are negotiating, who are oddly enough united on this front, they're it's the leadership that came from like two different factions in SAG, and they came together on this issue, and now they kind of find themselves pressured by the rank and file. I think they want a deal. And the word that I'm hearing is that it's not close. It's really not close, that they're kind of, you know, ticking things away at the edges. But the real issues remain unsettled, especially for writers. You know, the minimum staffing thing for writers is just deemed a non-starter. I think they're willing to do all the increased pension, health and welfare and all that kind of stuff for both unions. But, you know, the streaming residuals, that's a sticking point. And AI is a big sticking point. You know, they really are. So it's I think SAG stands a very good chance because of that letter of going out on strike just to finally push it. To push it hard, joining with the writers. And that is a worst case scenario for the producers. I think they were happy to get the directors to settle first, which they always do. And I think they want to pick off the actors so that they can put pressure on the writers and say, look, we've come to a deal with the other two. Now you guys got to bend a little bit. I think that's the idea, is divide and conquer. And I think those actors who signed that letter understand that.
Yeah,
and that's why they want to go out on strike, because I think they feel that if they join the writers, they're all stronger for it.
It's all leverage, because generally speaking, they're more or less fighting for like kind of the same stuff.
Yeah.
And you know what? Look, I think it was a mistake to push. I think that they should have dropped the ball. They should have dropped a hammer the first moment that they could drop the hammer.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. Those Teamsters, you over at UPS?
Yeah.
That guy who's leading them, he says, we are going on strike 1 second after midnight on whatever their strike deadline is. Like, and that guy is not kidding.
No.
He's like, because I'm thinking, they had the strike authorization vote a long time ago. That's leverage.
Yes.
We will not be pushing this down the road.
No.
We're going to go on strike. We will stop everything that moves in a brown truck or flies on a brown airplane. In this country, 1 second after midnight, you have to be there, dude. On the other hand, I know how to fix all of this. I know how to fix. Let me tell you. If I was the god of the writers' strike situation, this would probably work for SAG-AFTRA too. What I would say to the union members is, this is what we're going to do, folks. You know, pensions and this, that, and AI and whatever. I don't know anything about any of that, but we're gonna start paying actors a minimum rate of $5,000 a day. That's your first job on your first $5,000 a day is what we're gonna pay you, cash money. My point is, I would just throw a ridiculous amount of cash at writers and at actors right up front. When you get hired to work on a show, screenwriter, no matter what the fuck you do, you're gonna make $50,000. If you walk in the room and sit there and do nothing, you're going to make $50,000. And if you front load the process with ridiculous amounts of money, I can promise you that qualms and around all of that back end money, which is what writers really will go away. If I know that if I sell two scripts in a year, I can make $600,000.
There you go.
I won't fuck with you about shit that might happen 30 years from now.
See, this is the thing that I think the producers have never fully understood. And maybe they understand it, and they're just being hard asses and cruel about it. But the employment in the movie business, everybody thinks that, oh, it's so much money, you just get rich so fast and you're rolling in it. No. Here's the reality. You got people who will, and the tax structure doesn't favor this either. You have people who will sell a screenplay, $350,000, fantastic. Or they'll work on a show and they'll make, you know, $400,000 in a year. And you think, oh, that's amazing. You're buying a car, you're buying a house, you're making great. And then you don't sell another screenplay.
Yeah, for 5 years.
Or your show gets canceled.
Immediately.
And now the tax man has hit your $400,000 for about $180,000.
Yeah.
So, and your manager and your agent have taken out another, you know, $60,000.
Yep, that's gone.
Okay. So now your $400,000 is under $200,000. And you don't work for another 2 years.
Yeah, might not, dude.
So now you have dropped into what in a major city like Los Angeles or New York would call low income.
Yeah.
it is not the holy grail that everybody thinks it is, because everybody kind of measures it by the people that they see on TV and they read about in the trades. But, you know, for the rank and file, for those workaday writers who just bounce from writer's room to writer's room, who never sell a screenplay, who only write episodes, those directors who only ever write episodes, and those actors who never become movie stars, who never get nominated for Emmys, who just go on auditions all the time and they wait tables, or they do real estate, or they become yoga teachers between gigs,
or even if they become a workaday journeyman actor,
yeah.
It's the thing of it is, all of that used to make for a middle class. In Los Angeles, the Los Angeles, entertainment industry, middle class. And you could live yourself a life, buy yourself a house, put your kids through college. You wouldn't retire. No, you weren't rich. You just had a life, and it was a nice middle class life in the entertainment industry. That life is the life that's going to go away.
Yeah.
Shonda's going to be fine. You know,
and what makes it all so much worse is when people then read, oh, Ted Sarandos and Reed Hastings each took a $50 million bonus last year.
Yeah.
That's what pours salt in the wound.
Yeah, because those bonuses would completely pay for.
Yes.
Just last year's bonuses, by the way. You don't have to do it every year.
You know what? Take a $10 million bonus each.
Yep.
A gigantic whopping $10 million bonus. Go ahead. In addition to everything else that you've got, and take that other $80 million and pour that into writer and actor pension funds and shore up
the pay and actual just pay. Because I'm telling you, man, if you front load all of this with just when you are working, we're going to pay you stupid. I've had jobs like this, for one thing. I've had several gigs over the course of 35 years where, look, man, there is no job security here whatsoever. But this job pays $6,000 a week. So what do you want to do?
I'll leave it at this, you know, because we could go on this forever. But I'll leave it at this because my wife, who is a producer, as I think everybody knows, she's been in those situations where people will say they'll look at a budget that she's pulled together for a film. And they'll say, boy, you know, I mean, we see movies like this that get made for, you know, a lot less. I mean, can't you make this budget less? And her answer is always the same, which is no, because I believe in paying people.
Yeah.
And if you pay people, you get a good product.
You get a good product. Yeah. Yeah. You get people working hard at that job. I've always done the same thing myself. So anyway, that would be my solution. Yeah. If anybody out there is listening, just front load it with cash, man.
Yeah.
Front load it with cash.
It'll come back to you.
All right, what do we have? All right,
let's hit some TV real quickly. Okay. We've got a couple of big season, like all series, complete series box sets here that are insane. So Bonanza is finally, and at long last, thank you Paramount and CBS, is at long last out on DVD. The complete series in four. It's just a giant. This thing is so heavy. I think you could bench press it. It is 14 seasons in four of these big old keep cases in a sleeve. It is heavy. It is gnarly. Very smart. They got, you know, each of the three sons and then Lauren are all on a volume. Seasons 1 through 4, 5 through 8, 9 through 11, and 12 through 14. You know, I have a weird connection to two of these guys. Dan Blocker used to actually live in a house across the street from my mailbox.
Because your mailbox is at the bottom.
It's the bottom of a road, and it's far away. But he used to live in the house on the corner. Not when I was around. It was like before I was born. But he used to live in that. He used to live in that house.
Well, Dan died a long time ago.
I'll say all three sons are like big fixtures here in town because so Dan Blocker lived there, and then the beach further down in the city, just past Pepperdine University, is called Dan Blocker Beach.
Oh.
And the community center over at the ball fields is the Michael Landon Community Center.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I knew Michael was.
And then Pernell Roberts actually lived just up the hill from me all the way through when I was in high school. And I used to see him driving his car up and down and up and down all through the Trapper MD days.
Oh, yeah.
The Trapper John MD moment on TV. He literally lived across the street from Linda Lavin. We had a few celebrities here on the hill, right? It was Linda Lavin and Pernell Roberts and Olivia Newton-John, and then
Olivia was down on the beach. I remember that. Yeah.
And then a couple of screenwriters, and so it was a little Hollywood thing going on when I was growing up. But man, Pernell Roberts was the meanest dude. He was just the meanest dude. And I don't know if anybody knows this, but there's that moment during Bonanza where he just disappears from the show.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, where'd he go? Oh, well, and every episode, they're like, I wonder, have you heard from him? Is he, oh yeah, we just got a letter from him. He sent a telegram and he's doing this and he's doing that. And they're making up excuses literally every episode as to why he's not there. Truth was, he was just being a jerk. He was in a contract renegotiation. Oh. And he just said, I'm not going to come to work until you meet my terms. And he held the show hostage. But here's the thing about Bonanza, which, I think gets, in some respects, it gets a little too much credit, in some respects, not enough. But, Gunsmoke and The Big Valley and a lot mm-hmm. of these shows, Big mm-hmm. Valley was kind of a ripoff of Bonanza a little bit. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing about Bonanza. Bonanza drew an audience on Sunday nights year after year after year that today dwarfs the total number of people who watch all television on a mm-hmm. Sunday night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Everyone who watches television on a Sunday night, the total number of Americans now watching is dwarfed by the total number who watched just Bonanza in 1970.
Yeah. It was a 30 plus share all the time.
And there was a smaller population there.
That being because we were, and that was just extraordinary. Anything like that was extraordinary back then, but Bonanza and did it for year after year after year.
I'll say this. They should have come out with a Blu-ray. It's going to be like another year and a half before they come out with a Blu-ray. And they've been coming out with volumes of Bonanza now for like 15 years. People have been waiting for this for their kids are going to graduate high school. It's ridiculous. It should have happened a long time ago. 431 episodes, 14 seasons. And there's a couple hours of bonus material here that's really, really sweet and nostalgic. And if you're a fan, just get this. Don't wait for the Blu-ray because it's going to take just freaking forever.
If you happen to know, just because it's there on some press or whatever, what's the retail on that?
Oh boy, I have no idea.
Is it three digits?
It's three digits. Yeah, it's three digits for sure. I mean, you go to deepdiscount.com and find whoever has the cheapest, but I think it's around 130, 150, something like that.
Okay. I was just wondering. Yeah.
And then we also have Parenthood, the complete Parenthood. Bunch of episodes here directed by my friend Larry Trilling. Some good stuff. And Parenthood, not like the movie. The TV series was a totally different thing, but ran for six solid seasons. It's on Blu-ray. And comes from Universal, and a lot of this is a really sweet cast. I'd forgotten kind of what an endearing show this was, and they did a pretty good job. It's a pretty good job.
Yeah. Lauren and Monica Alvey. Yeah.
Jason Kadams was the central factor on this, who co-wrote Matt Reeves' directing debut, the Pallbearer.
Oh yeah,
I remember all that very, very well. It was an interesting moment. Let's talk Criminal Minds Evolution. Season 16, this is now two seasons longer than Bonanza. It's a little too much true crime profiling for me at this stage, but you tell me.
I don't know, dude. These things, all of them, eventually become, frankly, just sort of maudlin. You're digging into these sort of criminal these profiles or anything. And ultimately, I don't think that they're truthful at all. The thing about all of these shows, the NCIS, it's the Criminal Minds, the other, the idea was we're going to take you into the real way.
Yeah, yeah.
These things are done. We're going to show you how the cops are actually doing it. And you know what? I don't think they are. I think you're making this crap up. I don't think any of this works this way.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, it's an interesting sort of thing to me. So, but anyway, whatever. Criminal Minds.
We've also got The Event. You know, this was a, I don't know. This is from Mill Creek. It's on Blu-ray. The Event was an interesting, it was an interesting attempt at something that I think kind of didn't really ever catch fire. They got 22 episodes in. It was all kind of geared toward like a mystery thing. It was sort of, it was trying to be a little bit like Lost in some respects, but it was really, really, and I think it just became too much of a tease and without any payoff. It was all itch and no scratch.
You cannot have a television series called The Event
and never get to the event.
Yeah. You know, this sort of, it was conspiracy and all, and I felt like, you know what? They didn't know where they were going.
No.
It was like a framework, an idea, and you know, Cash, you got Jason Ritter and all these people. All right. But no one ever really knew what they were doing.
No.
And there was no event.
Jason Ritter is very good. Blair Underwood is very good. Everybody's very good, but yeah. It's an interesting curiosity.
This is the thing about any sort of, particularly a show like this. They cannot, and the X-Files did this to me. You know, the X-Files got to a moment of where you realize they were actually making it up. I mean, I know it's all made up, but you know what I mean? But you're actually making it up. Like, I think some of this you made up today, you know, and that's not actually storytelling.
Yeah. So we got a bunch of single season deals here. So let's start with the season one, the new Quantum Leap. Mm. Your dear Bridget was in the
Yes. Played Anita Hill.
That's right.
So this, look, they mixed it up. It's kind of interesting. I've enjoyed it. It was renewed, by the way. And I've enjoyed it more than I thought I would. Although it is, relatively speaking, not connected to the original Quantum Leap, other than, you know, what they're doing, jumping through time, at all.
Yeah.
You know, which is probably good. Just do your own thing.
SkyMed, which is not on Blu-ray. The Quantum Leap's on Blu-ray. SkyMed is on DVD from Paramount and CBS. Have you seen SkyMed?
I thought one of these shows, high stakes medical rescues is what they call it.
Yeah.
And look, here's the thing about that. You've seen one of those, you've seen them all.
I know.
You can only drag somebody into the sky or with the plane. Can the plane land on the extremely short runway? It's going to land.
I grew up on Emergency. You know, and that was like a whole thing. Oh my gosh, it was like Adam 12, except they're saving people every week. You know, somebody's crying and burning. Oh, help me! You know, dislodge them. And taking that show and sticking it in remote Canada and giving them a helicopter, it's the same show.
It's the same show. A little bit, a big dash of Baywatch, because all of these people are just fine as hell. Yeah. I'm like, really? Every one of you extremely fine people decided what you wanted to do.
Now, here's the thing. They have a really, I say helicopter. They have a really swanky plane in this thing.
It's a plane, yeah.
It's a plane. But I know some pilots who watch this show who could not care less whether anybody gets saved. They're just watching it for the plane.
They figure out a way to put these people in like bikinis and stuff at the lake in like every episode. Really? Every episode? Okay. Anyway. Yeah.
So we got another season one, which I never thought I'd see the day that Sylvester Stallone was on a TV show, but here it is. Tulsa King. You know, I guess it was inevitable,
Taylor Sheridan over there
It's a weird thing. So, you know, Stallone is this guy who's gotten out of prison, and it all takes place in Oklahoma because I guess they got tax credits, and it's like The Sopranos set in Oklahoma, maybe. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, look, it's the joke. being that he's just sort of, you know, out because he's been away in jail. He doesn't know that weed is a, you know, whatever. The joke doesn't play for an entire series, right? Because come on, dude, catch up. First of all, if you want to be savvy on what's going on in the world, go to prison. you'll be caught up on everything in the world. But nevertheless, that joke just can't keep playing. Yeah, what I like about it is that Dana Delaney's in it. And she's Dana Delaney.
Oh, thank goodness for Dana Delaney. Now, Stallone's not bad. He's fine. It's set in Oklahoma. No offense to Oklahoma. I got a lot of good friends who come from Oklahoma, family in Oklahoma, but don't really want to watch it every week.
You know what they were going for? They were going for the Ozarks thing. But the writing isn't that clever. It is Guido in Oklahoma. Old Guido in Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's very Soprano-y.
Yeah, and he solves all on the prairie by punching people or, you know, shooting them.
We got a season 2 of La Brea. Oh my goodness! I think this is the dumbest show. This is an absolutely stupid show. It really is. So the big joke in Los Angeles is that when you say, oh, let's go to the La Brea tar pits, La Brea means the tar in Spanish. So the very, very funny humorist Stan Freberg once said that when you say the La Brea tar pits, you are literally saying the tar pits. Stan Freberg did Harry Puma in Looney Tunes. Anyway, this is season 2 of this weird show that's kind of like Outlander, and
the land of time forgotten.
When you decide that you're going to go to 10,000 BC, you've got to make an effort to make me believe that we're in 10,000 BC, as opposed to, oh, look, they went and dug up some costumes from, you know, some old gladiator movie from the studio wardrobe department. It's not convincing. It's hokey and it's very silly. But I guess people are watching it because this thing is coming back for season 3, isn't it?
Yeah, people watch a lot of really terrible television stuff. Sherman, our homie Sherman, right? Yeah. There's a character in this that Sherman actually got the part. But he turned it down because he also got the part on Into the Badlands. Much better choice. Look, this is still going. He's on Stranger Things now anyway, so it doesn't really make any difference. But I'm like, Sherman Burr, you dodged a bullet because between Nathaniel Moon on Into the Badlands and the guy in this, oh my gosh, it's just it's a thing.
Season 3. We got a season 3 of The L Word, Generation Q, on Showtime. Not sure we needed this, but they can't come up with anything new anymore.
I know we didn't need it because our good friend, my great lesbian girlfriend, Bea, who I went to see this past weekend, you know, I told her about this, and she's like, but why? I'm like, Bae, you want to watch the L Word? Because Bae was a big L Word fan. I used to actually take her to these lesbian L Word watching parties back in 2001, 2004, whenever the L Word was out, right? Yeah. That was a big thing. That was a thing. And this is not a thing.
Funny. Yeah, it's old. Everything that's old is old again. Yeah. And then we've gotten to a season 6 on SEAL Team with David Boreanaz, and I've got to give credit to David Boreanaz. I think he sustains this. I can't believe this thing made it to season 6, but there it is.
David Boreanaz.
Yeah.
Along with I think we talk about this occasionally, along with Scott Bakula.
Yeah,
are some of the a couple of the wealthiest guys. These guys. David was Angel on Buffy
several seasons. Angel on Angel.
Then he was Angel on these.
Then he was on Bones.
Then he was on Bones for like 10, 12 seasons.
I know.
This 6 seasons. Let me tell you something. Any person who's just a movie star during that period of time, maybe other than Tom Cruise, has not made as much money as David. He's an executive producer on all these shows. Scott Bakula, he was on, he was the first Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
Then he was captain of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
Scott. And he's been down there in one of those NCISs. In
New Orleans.
For about a decade. Unreal. You know, five, six, seven, 8 years, you know, like literally 40 years of television, these guys.
It's unreal. It's unreal. I mean, yeah, and it's not a bad show. It's not a bad show. It's a little bit redundant. It's a little bit repetitive, but you know, they've got a woman on it, so it's it's not completely testosterone. But you know, SEAL Team Season 6.
Yeah,
there it is.
Yeah.
From Showtime, we got Speak, which you know, with Kristen Stewart. You know, I don't know.
I didn't see this.
Yeah, this is one of those teen angst movies that kind of just faded away on Showtime at one point. Hmm. And I don't think it ages terribly well, but they've released it. It's you know, there's a party and things go wrong, and you know, Kristen Stewart gets to act all angsty and teeny. I mean, it's in the Me Too era, in the moment that we are in, where these things have almost saturated the media, I guess there's still some resonance to something like this, but it really does feel a little bit exploitive, despite her otherwise decent performance. Ozzie and Harriet, season 11 and 12. This crazy show just kept on going. You know, it's more Ozzie and Harriet. I don't really know what to tell you, but it's nice to have it out. This was kind of the original nuclear family show. You know, the 50s were defined by all the nuclear family shows, Ozzie and Harriet and Leave It to Beaver and the Donna Reed Show. And then in the 60s, everybody got divorced, and it was,
Of course, father
and Family Affair and the Andy Griffith Show and on and on and on. And the Brady Bunch. Right. Yeah. So it's a little funny how that happened, that there's really a social trend there, but the original nuclear family show before everybody got divorced was Ozzie and Harriet. And
Of course, this is weird because they were actual family.
Yeah, exactly. You wonder, like, did they have any family time? All right. And then I'm just going to make quick work of a bunch of
Ricky Nelson.
Yeah.
Had these twins.
Yeah.
And they were like rock stars in maybe the 80s, maybe the 90s. I can't remember exactly. Yeah,
my wife was in high school with them. I think they were younger.
Yeah.
They were younger. I think her younger brother, who you know.
Yeah.
I think they were in his grade.
Okay, yeah.
I think they were in his grade. I think they, but they, anyway, they all, yeah, they, and they didn't have the long hair then, but everybody knew. Yeah. Like, oh, it's the Nelson twins.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Nelson, remember Nelson? They had that song, and they're like rocking their hair all around, trying to do the hairband thing.
Yeah. They had a little thing there for a second, yeah.
So got a bunch of Hallmark stuff here. I'm just going to make quick mention of it because it's all basically the same. There, I saw a joke the other day that, you know, the goal for the Hallmark Channel in 2023 is to come up with another plot, something like that. Anyway, they're all, you know, sweet little romancy things. Find a couple of pretty people who work for scale. So there is got an original Hallmark movie. Oh my gosh, a Hallmark Channel original movie? Another one? Really? They make them like every 6 days. So this is called Taking a Shot at Love with Luke McFarland and Alexa Penavega. I'll let you guess what that's about.
Yeah.
Got one that's holiday themed here. Didn't come out during the holidays. I don't know why. It's called Christmas Waltz. And this one is with Lacey Chabert, who we all love, and Will Kemp. Huh. And then we have another one with Lacey Chabert. This one is Lacey Chabert with Autumn Reeser and Allison Sweeney. It's called The Wedding Veil Expectations. There are a few of these Wedding Veil movies. They're all basically the same. Not sure what makes them different from the non-Wedding Veil movies, but anyway. And this one is called Love and Sunshine with Danica McKellar and Mark Declan. And I just want to point out, I really don't think that after all these movies that there are any white actors left in Hollywood. I think it's truly unbelievable. It's hilarious. Another Christmas one. This is with Candace Cameron Bure and Tim Razan. It's called Christmas Town. Goodness, heaven help us all. Signed, sealed, delivered, the complete series. This is a series, Tim. Mm. It's Canadian. And I think there were maybe like five episodes of this thing. It's same deal. We also have now on DVD, because these were not good enough to actually put on Blu-ray, apparently. Color My World with Love, a Hallmark Movies and Mysteries original movie. A Hallmark Movies and Mysteries original movie is fascinating. It's and this one is like a romance between two people with Down syndrome. It's sweet. But it feels a little exploitative at the same time.
No, very exploitative.
And then we have one called Love, Fall, and Order, which almost looks like a parody of itself. There's a dog in the picture, and I don't know. It's got a whole Thanksgiving fall festival theme. And oh my gosh, Tim, are you looking? Can you see what I'm showing you?
There's black people on that cover.
Wow, Hallmark, what's going on? Hallmark Movies and Mysteries, To Her with Love, part of their Mahogany line. Are they serious with that? Really? Are you serious?
Hey, black folks want to get some of that Hallmark money too. That's cool. That's cool.
Oh my gosh. No, we're fine with Hallmark. We're ribbing them.
Knock it out.
They have a role to play.
Yes. Because look, and you or I have been around long enough, particularly during that the early VHS run.
Yeah.
When if it were in a VHS store, It was a perfectly worthy movie to watch because there it was, a movie. Yeah. And then that kind of went away. And then when DVDs came around, there was a whole that first straight to DVD sort of run there. Yeah. There were a lot of decent movies in those runs, you know.
Yeah.
But there wasn't very much theatrical releasing and people were so there's, you know, this space for all this kind of stuff. The audiences are very specific and they generate enough dough to keep these movies coming.
Very true. Very, very true. What should we hit? We got new movies. We got Criterion stuff. We got a whole ton of stuff here. We got 4Ks.
Let's look at a few 4Ks. I see that John Wick chapter 4 is there. I got to tell you, I dug John Wick chapter 4. It was too long.
The screening I was at, actually, they had Keanu and Chad Stahelski were both there for Q&A afterwards.
Oh, that's wicked.
Yeah, it was great. I took Nadim and it was hilarious. It was hilarious. Keanu is so loose now. Yeah. As opposed to, you know, he used to kind of be a little intimidated by the fame and didn't like to do press and stuff. But he is so loose now. He comes to these things and he just starts riffing and he's ribbing Chad Stahelski. He's telling stories. He goes, I'm not supposed to tell this story, but let me tell you about this guy. And he's laying it out there. It's really fun. It's really fun. And he's loose in this thing, too. And he gives all the props to the like the scene where he's rolling down the stairs over and over and over. And it's just brutal. And he goes, yeah, that was my stunt man. And he lays it out. He goes, you give that guy all the props, man. He just took it over and over and over. He's given all the credit to the stunt man. As opposed to Mr. Cruise.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it.
And he was even making some Tom Cruise jokes. He, like, people were like, did you do your own stunts? He goes, yeah, it's Tom. I don't, I'm not going to do that. I'm too old for that. It's very funny.
And I just love that. Look, Tom, Mission Impossible, I guess we'll be out by the time this drops. God bless Tom, but Tom racked his nuts up. Back there a while ago doing that. So Keanu was like, nope, I like walking.
But this should be the last chapter, but they keep, you know, as long as they keep making money, they're going to keep making these things. No, there's a lot of fun stuff in this thing. And I think Skarsgård is a good heavy. You know, we saw that already in the It films, but he's not a clown here. He's just, You know, the whole mythology of John Wick is really what makes it so much fun. I mean, it all started with a guy who got pissed off because he killed his dog.
Yeah.
And the whole mythology of this worldwide assassin network where quite literally almost like if I'm watching this, I'm thinking, am I the only person who's not getting a piece of this assassin money? Because I'm feeling really left out. Everybody seems to be an assassin. Everybody seems to be in on the bounty.
Yeah, and everybody also seems to be willing to kill each other. That seems to be a perfectly sort of socially acceptable sort of thing to do, which is anyway. It goes way way over the top. One of the last films of the wonderful late Lance Reddick.
So good.
He was so good.
Yeah, I'm gonna miss him, man. That is the fine actor and kind of the heart and soul of the series because he was the only guy who really seemed to have a moral center, you know.
I'm actually doing this for real.
Yeah,
you people seem to think this is a game,
and he's the only one who never betrayed John. He never turned on him.
Yeah.
So that's very sad. But anyway, beautiful Ultra HD transfer. You know, we'll probably get a bigger box set, a complete box set with the whole 4K thing. And the first three had their own box set, but they're going to come up with a new one holiday season. Just wait for it. We'll get this in another one. So you might want to wait to upgrade. But it's got its share of extras and stuff on it. Exactly what you'd expect. It's all kind of behind the scenes stuff. And Donnie Yen is terrific in it. Mm-hmm. Donnie just keeps on going. Jackie Chan and Jet Li, their careers have more or less long since expired. And Donnie, their contemporary, is having a lease on life like nobody's business. So
those stunts caught up with Jet and Jackie, all that big stuff, you know. Donnie always kept it sort of tight and close, and
he did.
And you know, I see you got the Transformers box.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, Rise of the Beasts is actually doing pretty good.
Is it?
They're making a few bucks out there right now. I'm super duper surprised, but you know, among the your Raiders didn't nope so well.
No,
Rise actually made more money than that.
Fascinating. That is really fascinating. Yeah, I mean, they keep trying to squeeze and they reinvent the Transformers thing every so often, right? I mean, the only thing that's constant between these are the Transformer films. Mm-hmm. Mark Wahlberg isn't in here, and they gave up on Shia LaBeouf a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
You ever see that compilation stuff of Shia in all of his Transformers movies? And it's just it's a compilation of every moment where Shia is running and going, no, 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 no. It goes for like 7 minutes. It's just Shia LaBeouf running, going, no, 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 being chased by robots. It's hilarious.
Oh, I love that. I gotta see that.
Anyway. Six Transformers films in this big old box set, 4K with digital code, Blu-ray Ultra HD combos. And, I don't care for these films at all, but a lot of people love them. And if giant fighting robots is your thing, then just knock yourself out. Much more my speed, if we could just go there for a second. The 100th anniversary 4K releases coming out from Warner Brothers, I think, are pretty sweet. There's a lot of really, really fun stuff there. And two of them this week. We've got a newish film, Evil Dead Rise.
Mm-hmm.
This is, kind of in the vein of the original Evil Dead. Not nearly as good. I guess for fans, it's fine. Movies Anywhere code on this thing. You know, it's okay. It's the same mythology. It's a little silly. It's a little scary. Mm-hmm. But much more my speed, Tim. Mm-hmm. Vacation. National Lampoon's Vacation. Oh, yeah. Chevy Chase. Written by John Hughes.
The original.
Absolutely. I love this movie. I love it more now than I think I ever have in my life. Harold Ramis directed it just beautifully. I mean, you think about that. John Hughes, Harold Ramis, Chevy Chase, National Lampoon branded crazy movie where he's not anybody's idea of a good dad. But boy, what a funny movie this is. John Candy has a little brief cameo in it. Imogen Coca's grandma, So funny. So unbelievably funny.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was just wonderful. And it looks so many the guys who are gone now. William Hickey. Around the tour. He's just going. Doris Roberts is walking around this movie. Randy Quaid is still around, but he's not still around.
Yeah,
depending on how, in a certain sort of way, way, Randy's gone. That was mean. I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, but you know what I mean.
I know we get it. It's just a really, really fun film. And it's silly. We don't have silly comedies like this anymore. So it's a nice
movie. I forgot Johnny Galecki played Rusty because they swapped Rusties somewhere.
They changed Rusties for after this one. Yeah.
After this one. Yeah. So that was Johnny. Yeah. Man, Johnny's done well. Johnny's still around. Big Bang. Way to go, Johnny. Yeah.
A new film, Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, on 4K. Absolutely ridiculous. Just as bad as the previous Dungeons and Dragons movie from about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Absolutely stupid beyond belief. I don't even know why they keep trying. They just wanted to brand this thing. It's a whole lot of actors who should have known better. It's a mythical quest. Something's going on. And, there's a whole thing where... what's his name's daughter, Chris Pine's got a daughter and he's got to leave her behind. And when he becomes a fugitive and then he's got to put a team together to get her back. And, Michelle Rodriguez is like playing tough, which she always does.
Yes,
then the hot guy from Netflix show shows up for
16
seconds. He shows up for 16 seconds and, smiles. And it's just dumb. It doesn't make any sense. And things turn into dragons. And I hated this. I hated every second of it.
And painfully bad sometimes, too, really. There's that whole sequence when they're supposed to go on trial. They're up there and they're doing this whole joke about him because he's waiting. Oh, isn't what's his name supposed to be? It's this whole sequence. And I'm like, I know that this is supposed to be a joke, but it's just not funny.
There's like this race of witches who are double crossing. I couldn't keep up with any of it. It just didn't, I'm too old for that stuff. Creepshow. We got a 4K of Creepshow Collector's Edition.
1982 Creepshow. The old
82.
George Romero.
Scream Factory, Shout Factory release. Pretty great. A ton of extras on here. Huge amount of extras. The fantastic scan from the original camera negative is just gorgeous. And a George Romero and Tom Savini commentary is just fabulous. Got another commentary with the director of photography and a third commentary with the construction coordinator and the first assistant director, which is okay. Mm-hmm. But it's really the Romero and Savini commentary that you want to listen to. That's the brilliant one. And you know what? This is a really sharp film. It's a fun, it's not scary at all. Never was intended to be, but, Stephen King, the story in here with Stephen King and probably the only thing that he's ever acted in is hilarious.
Yeah. When he turns into
still so good and so funny. Anyway, tons of interviews and featurettes, galore. It's a fan's cornucopia of goodies. Definitely check it out. And a really, really great 4K transfer. Mm. Terrific 4K transfer. Did you see the Mario Brothers movie? Super Mario Brothers movie?
I did not. It also made money, though. Among things that are doing well, comparatively speaking, Mario Brothers movie doing good.
I did not see that coming. I really didn't. I mean, I'm usually pretty good at getting in front of things, but man, this thing just blew the doors off. And
as opposed to the one from 30 years ago?
With the live action thing with John Leguizamo, I gotta say this. Look, I love John Leguizamo, but he's apparently really, really pissed off that they didn't bring him back because he says, I thought we're in a diversity moment. It's like, dude, you're Puerto Rican, or Colombian. He's like half Colombian or whatever. But these are Italian plumbers. You're not Italian. Like, what are you talking about?
You weren't Italian the first time either, by the way.
Like, you weren't Italian, but
neither was Bob Hoskins.
No, but he also played Toulouse-Lautrec in Moulin Rouge. So what are you whining to stop? You know, you have a great career. Don't be that guy who just whines at every job you don't get. You get great jobs. He's like Osamo.
I still agree with him about, what is it? Castro.
Oh yeah.
James Franco's Castro. Nope, yeah, I agree with him on that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, this movie made money. Chris Pratt and Anya Taylor. I don't know. It's just really weird. You know what is doing well, and what is.
I agree.
It's not this Into the Spider-Verse. You know, both animated, obviously.
Yeah.
But completely different audiences. I think. Yeah. I guess. I don't know. I don't know the audience for this Mario Brothers movie. Is this a hero movie? This would not be hero, would it?
No, it's just a big video game, man. It's just a big big 3D video game.
But I mean, hero. Your daughter. Would she?
Oh, no, she wouldn't get near this.
Yeah, right. This is the movie for grown-ups, I think.
You know, she's 10 years old. You know, she says last night is the funniest thing. I'm like, oh no, is this what I've raised? She says, and you know, she loves all things Disney, or at least as far as the parks are concerned. Mm. But she says, wow, they've got to stop making sequels. They don't have any new ideas. And I thought, oh, Disney, you're in such trouble. If a 10-year-old is saying that, you're in trouble.
That is so sharp, so sharp.
They don't have any new ideas. She's very disappointed. They don't have any new ideas.
As well she should be. Very sophisticated.
Also, from the wonderful people at MVD Visual, we have a 4K of Rain Man for Academy Awards, including Best Picture, which may be one of the best performances Tom Cruise has ever given, because and you've always pointed this out. Yeah, and I thank you for it. Is that everyone's always like, oh, Dustin Hoffman. Oh, Dustin Hoffman's so amazing. And you're the guy that was always saying, you realize that Dustin Hoffman is doing a shtick.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise is the one who's really acting in this.
Yes. He's carrying this whole movie.
He carries the whole movie. He really does.
Dustin's just standing over there with that bit he's doing.
Yeah.
And we love the bit, but it's a bit. And, and you know, you pick a bit, and he picked a good bit, and then you just do the bits, like my left foot. You know, I love that, but basically, homie's just going to lay there on the floor.
Yeah.
and swing that foot around. And it's a thing, and it's intense, but it's a bit, you know. Yeah. And meanwhile, everybody else in this movie is acting their asses off.
I'll tell you, watching this again, when it gets to the big emotional payoff at the end, and it gets you, it really does. I mean, that's why this won Best Picture. Mm. And this won Best Picture in a year where Mississippi Burning was expected to be a runaway hit until somebody raised their hand and said, the white FBI guys are not supposed to be the heroes of this story. Yeah. And everybody got guilty and was like, oh, what else is there? Rain Man. And everybody turned their attention to Rain Man. And there is that emotional payoff at the end, which is it's a kicker. But you know, it's not Dustin Hoffman who earns that emotion. It's Tom Cruise who earns that moment.
Mm-hmm. And it does a thing that movies that it knew to do. Barry Levinson, obviously.
Yeah.
It does a thing that it's interesting that it knew to do way back in '88 that the Hollywood forgot about later when you get to things like Beautiful Mind or whatever.
Yeah.
Barry, he knew, you know what? The love of a good brother is not going to fix what's wrong with Raymond.
Yep.
This is Raymond, and he will always be this way. And Tom Cruise, he loves his brother, but he realizes.
Yep.
This he's always going to be this way. And just because I love him, that ain't going to fix him. I'm going to have to deal with this shit. That's all there is to it.
True. 25th anniversary. I hate to make us feel old, but 25th anniversary of The Truman Show.
Mm.
You know what, Tim? This movie holds up.
Yeah.
It's kind of faded a little bit. Peter Weir working at his maximum capacity. Everybody was involved in this. This is a classic Hollywood studio film like they just don't make anymore. Late 90s, just killing it. Scott Rudin producing, Andrew Niccol wrote it, Peter Weir directed it, and it has got Jim Carrey in an amazing dramatic performance. Mm. It's got Laura Linney. It's got Ed Harris. Mm. It's got
Holland Taylor and
Natasha McElhone.
I mean, this movie today, this movie,
Paul Giamatti.
We watch. There's a Black Mirror. It's, you know, Black Mirror dropped.
Yeah,
there's a Black Mirror, and that Black Mirror is holding completely a reference.
Yeah,
to Truman Show.
Yeah.
Now, if you wouldn't know that unless you know what do you say 25th anniversary. Yeah, because I don't know, but I can think of at least a dozen either other movies or television programs or references to things that speak to the Truman Show. Sometimes by simply just having in dialogue the word. Truman, the phrase Truman Show.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess you got to be a certain age, but you know what they're talking about.
It happens at least once a month that I will hear somebody just casually, and they're always somewhat of a certain age, but someone just casually go, man, I feel like I'm in the Truman Show.
Yeah.
You're right. It's become for a certain generation part of the vernacular. And of mm-hmm. course, you know, if you don't know what we're talking about, then you need to get this.
You should watch that movie. Yeah,
it's just and it is a great, great 4K transfer. Paramount doesn't always do the best with their 4Ks, but man, they really did a great job here. Peter Weir, who should still be directing a lot of movies, but is very frustrated by the way the state of Hollywood. But man, really great.
Andrew Niccol. And it's an original screenplay, too.
Yes.
Again, back then, you could just have an idea like this, write a really, really great screenplay. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood, at the biggest level, would take this really forward-thinking sort of high concept. That's what they called this kind of stuff back then, high concept. And let you make it. Today, you couldn't make this film because it would have to be based on a graphic novel.
Exactly.
Or a book or something. But before they would let you do it.
I don't know why Andrew Niccol doesn't have the same kind of career as a Tarantino or as a Christopher Nolan. You know, these are the guys who are sort of our big auteurs of the moment. Because Niccol's every bit as visionary and writes just as well, if not
better. Gattaca, dude.
We also have a Steelbook coming right here in my hand, Best Buy exclusive, Lord of War, which he wrote and directed with Nicolas Cage in one of his last great real performances as an arms dealer, an international arms dealer. And this is this film
loosely playing that guy we traded loosely.
Yes.
Playing that guy we traded for somebody. I don't know. We traded with the guy with Victor Boot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, this is such a prescient movie, and 4K just kills it. It's beautifully done. Some great performances in here by people we forget were even in this thing. You know, Ian Holm is in this thing. Mm. Ethan Hawke is here, you know, from Gattaca. Jared Leto is in this thing. I mean, this is a really, really rock solid film. Beautifully shot by Philippe Rousselot. Just beautifully shot. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful 4K transfer. Great audio. I mean, it just kills it across the board. So that's a Best Buy exclusive if you want to get that. But man, Andrew Niccol, I miss him making bigger movies. I wish he'd kind of get a second wind at some point. And then lastly on the 4K front here, Insidious is on 4K in a Steelbook.
I got to see the new Insidious film for the radio show this week, next week.
Yeah.
The Red Door or something like Insidious, The Red Door.
Help me understand the appeal. I just don't get it.
Me either. So I'm kind of with you there. The original one, you know, 2010. I guess the thing that Patrick Wilson's is Patrick in all of them. I think Patrick Wilson is in all of these things. If I'm not
mistaken. Yes, he is.
He's in
this one at least. Yeah, the original.
And they sort of like carry over. I don't know.
I mean, James. I'll say this. James Wan is a very, very good director with these kinds of films. Whether it's the whatever it is, the Harkening, the Awakening, whatever that other one.
The Conjuring.
With that or the Saw films. I mean, James Wan has this down. He's a very, very adept director with this kind of material.
Yeah.
I just don't like the material.
Yeah, I've never been into this particular kind of stuff, but I understand, you know, what a Spiral I think he's one of the producers over there on Megan. Did you see Megan a little bit?
Yeah, totally.
It's what they do, you know. It's what they do. Yeah,
for sure. Let's see what else we got. You know, a few docs and a concert thing here real quickly. Let me just mention the comedy specials that they are releasing now from Mill Creek. They've had a few of those. And they got a new one, Maria Bamford, stand-up spotlight, two comedy specials. Very funny. I love Maria Bamford. Those who don't know Maria Bamford, she does this thing with her voice, which is just surreal. It's like when she turns it on, it slays. It absolutely just kills. And no human being should be able to reproduce that sound. So it's hilarious. I think she's great. I love her. I think she's really funny. And this is a good disc to have. Some docs here real quick. A Life's Work from First Run Features is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful documentary. And it's basically looking at a group of people who have dedicated their lives to doing specific things that are just off everybody else's radar. One of them, for example, is Jill Tarter, who directs the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the SETI Institute. You also have the people who founded the Champion Tree Project. Mm-hmm. You've got music archivist Robert Darden, who founded the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project. All these people, they are inspired by things and they inspire others. And it's a really, really interesting subject. It's the topic is about people who are passionate and passionate about things that maybe a lot of other people wouldn't be passionate about.
And things that can't be completed. Probably
in your lifetime,
and their lifetimes can't be completed. There you are doing this thing that you almost by definition can't quote unquote succeed at. And the question is, it's very interesting stuff.
And then we've got Muhammad Ali, aka Cassius Clay, Blu-ray of this, which is kind of a strangely forgotten film, but if you don't know this history, and a lot of people don't, a lot of people grew up just knowing him as Muhammad Ali, but there's a really fascinating trajectory and a duality to his life, and in many respects it's almost a counterpoint to that of Elvis Presley. I've always looked at the two. I mean, I think maybe because my father always made that a point of reference, admired the hell out of them both, but always underlined that, each one had a very, very different attitude. One of them served voluntarily in the military and the other one said, I don't want to go kill people who haven't done anything to me. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting life. And this is a really great, a great look at the not just the man, but at the phenomenon that surrounded him, I guess is maybe the better way of putting it. So, a lot of aspects of Muhammad Ali's life that are illuminated here. And I think this is a really sharp, sharp film. Let's see. Last two here. Matter Out of Place, which is from Icarus. This is a strangely poetic kind of essay documentary film about garbage. And it travels all over the world and goes to all the most far-flung remote places to see and to poetically photograph how they dispose of their waste. And you forget that everybody's got to get rid of their trash. No matter where you go in those beautiful places, they've got trash and they got to get rid of it somehow. So this shines a light on a very, very interesting topic and a strange problem that we don't often think about. We like to kind of pretend it doesn't exist. So, and it's a little too pretty, but what a fascinating film and a fascinating topic. And then the last one here is Kubrick by Kubrick, which is from documentarian Gregory Monroe. This was at Tribeca a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. And the Michel Simon book on Kubrick, which was revised just at the very end there to include some Eyes Wide Shut stuff. But that Michel Simon book was my Bible growing up. I read that thing. I looked at every page of it, the photographs, the comparisons, the essays, the analyses, reading the interviews. And Michel Simon, whom I've actually met him at Cannes some years ago, conducted some really amazing interviews, and they use those interviews as the basis for this kind of essay study of Kubrick in film form. And this may be, for my money, the best movie about Kubrick and his films ever made. I would highly recommend it. It's only an hour long. It should be longer, but there's probably a better movie to be made at some point in the future. But for now, this is the best we've got. And I wish it was on Blu-ray. It's not. It's on DVD. But you know, in the absence of anything else, it's pretty great.
Most of that good chunk of that hour are things that I simply have never been heard. Are recordings of Kubrick, mostly audio, but nevertheless, and have never been heard before. So it's a worthy hour, just in that you will not have heard most of this before.
Yes, very, very true. Let's hit some new films, and then we'll probably call it quits after that. Let's see.
All right. I see you got X there, which I thought was a really good. Mia Goth was fantastic in that film. It's from that guy, T. What's his name? T.I. or T? T. West.
Yeah.
And what I love about this film, these people are going to go out on this farm and make this porno. It's all set in about 1978, 79, something like that. And Kid Cudi is in it. He's really good too. And Brittany Snow and everybody. And they're going to go out there and make this porno. What I loved about it is that it looked like a film. This film looks like a film that was made in the 70s, right? And then when we see this footage of the little porno that they're making, it looks like one of those pornos that they made in the 70s. Yeah. You know, he changed the frame and sort of all color. It looks like it's set when it's set, and then it looks like it's doing what it's doing. Yeah. And then there's this creepy couple, and it becomes a horror movie.
And then we've got Transfusion with Sam Worthington, whom nobody recognizes anymore because he's always hidden behind blue CG in those Avatar movies.
Yeah, man. I'm glad he gets paid well for those.
I hope so.
Because they have really jacked up his career.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was originally supposed to be Mad Max in Mad Max Fury Road. He was the original guy cast. I don't know why he fell out. He's Australian, you would think, but I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, I know why, but anyway, go on.
So he's this is just a generic, this movie's called Transfusion. It's generic action thing. He's a special forces guy. One more mission, one of those movies. It's a payday.
I like the guy he plays in this, though. He's this dad.
Yeah,
you know, he's got this kid and his kid's like totally and completely not like him.
Yeah,
but he's kind of okay with that.
Yeah.
You know, takes his kid out to go hunting in this one scene, right? It's this scene. You've seen it 1,000 times. Kid has a gun. The deer is over there. He's got his kid supposed to shoot the deer. Kid can't shoot the deer because the kid's not the kind of person who can shoot the deer. And he says, you know what? And he tells his dad, I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I'm just not strong like you. And his dad says, you know what? You told me no. That's pretty strong. And that was a dynamic that you just don't see. They just could have went the ordinary way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they didn't. He wasn't that guy. Then this whole movie is built around the fact that he's really not that guy. He was trained to be that guy.
Yeah.
And he just does what he has to do, but he's really not that guy. Interesting stuff, but it's payday.
Well, here's another interesting one. A grueling little indie film, but Willem Dafoe is always worth watching. Animorph. Willem Dafoe plays a detective, deeply disturbed detective, one of those really detectives who just brings his work home and trying to catch a killer. And the case just gets darker and weirder and deeper. And turns out the killer is watching him while he's trying to watch the killer. It's really interesting psychological thing. It ultimately doesn't. I don't think it totally all hangs together if you think too much about it, but you don't worry too much about it. Defoe is fantastic. Scott Speedman is really surprisingly good. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a sharp little movie. Mm-hmm. Did you see One Day as a Lion?
I don't think I did.
What a great surprise this is. I really is. This is like, there are a lot of these kind of faux Tarantino wannabe films, and this is kind of one of them, but it's, I really thoroughly enjoyed this. It's a fantastic vehicle for Scott Kahn, who wrote it and basically wrote it for himself, but it's, It's about a guy.
Frank's in it. Frank Grillo.
Frank Grillo's so good. I mean, he's so good. And he's back to being like that ruthless criminal guy. I mean, he's the heavy in this thing. But it's so quirky and so fascinating. Basically, Scott Kahn is a reluctant hitman. He's not an assassin, but he's doing this basically to satisfy a debt. And he can't bring himself to do it or to do it right. And, you know, he's supposed to kill J.K. Simmons, who's his, like, you know, almost his crazy urban cowboy guy. And, you know, Frank Grillo's the heavy. He's, you know, he's going to make him do it. If he doesn't do it, then they're going to kill him. And, you know, the mechanics of, you know, the hit don't really make sense. If you're going to kill the guy that you hired to kill somebody else, then why didn't you go kill the person in the first place? Right.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, there's just there are too many steps between killing the person that you need to kill. It's just like a hit is not supposed to be that complicated. But if you can get over that. Khan's character is so fascinating, and he takes a hostage, this waitress, and that becomes a relationship and a thing, and her mom, and there's all this stuff going on, and you know, it's very kind of Blood Simple-y, it's very kind of Tarantino-y in some respects. It's a sharp little movie, and I give Scott Kahn all the credit in the world for a script that is unusual. It's genre, but yet it's very, very of its own thing. And he wrote it for himself, and it's not vain. And you know, this is one of those grindstone movies again that we make fun of, but this one is really sharp.
Now, hey, look, J.K. Simmons, Virginia Madsen,
Tara
Manning. You know, there's some weight in there.
Virginia Madsen plays the mom. She's so good. She's so good. Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda have just they got to stop it. This thing that they're doing, this shtick, it's
Katie for Brady.
Moving on. What can you say? I don't know. Did you see this?
Well, you know, what are you going to do? And you know, Sally Field.
Yeah, right? Not in this one. This is just the two of them together. Paul Weitz wrote it, who's a better writer than this. But I mean, it's just that, you know, they're just kind of. They're overdoing it, and I don't know that you can rein the two of them in. You know, it's a shtick that they're doing. It's an old lady shtick, and you know, Malcolm McDowell is along for the ride, and Richard Roundtree shows up here for some reason. I don't really know what the point is. He deserves a better movie, but anyway, there it is. You know, if you want to watch the two of them kind of do their thing, and by all means, go for it. Magic Mike's Last Dance.
That was surprisingly good.
It was, wasn't it?
You know, and as opposed to the second one, which I thought was, you know, the first one was very good. And
Soderbergh came back for this one.
Yeah, and what's good about it is because he knew to sort of wrap this thing back around to the first one, so that we can wrap up Mike's journey here.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, he sort of didn't make a joke of it. It's kind of serious, and while still being a film that's, you know, very it understands that we are here for the ladies. Selma Hayek is this woman who hires him to give her a special dance. Yeah.
Yes, and he winds up basically choreographing a big Broadway, a big West End show in London. Goes from being a stripper to choreographing a show. Let me tell you my analogy. Magic. Forget about the second film. Just erase that from the equation. Magic Mike's Last Dance is to Magic Mike as Staying Alive is to Saturday Night Fever.
I love it.
It is. And I am very forgiving of Staying Alive, which I still think is Stallone's best directing effort. And for all the flack that film takes for its, you know, very 80s-ness, I actually think it's a really fun film. I think it's a whole lot of fun. Cocaine Bear, dude.
That was nuts. Elizabeth Banks, just nuts. That movie.
I talked about this on the radio. Christy loved it. I hated this movie. I think it's stupid.
that was just nuts. Great CGI.
Yeah, I mean, but Ray Liotta, is this literally his last film or is it second to last?
Good question. I'm not sure. Well, you're thinking, you know, Kerry Russell.
Basically, here's the thing. They go based in real events. I hate it when they do that now. Here are the real events. Somebody lost some cocaine, dumped out of an airplane, and apparently a bear got into it at some point. That's it. That's literally
that's all of it.
This movie, the bear goes on a rampage and is like eating people and tearing people apart. And the, and it's supposed to be gory and it's supposed to be funny. And it just, it just goes so far off the rails. It really does. Yeah. At a certain point, it's just, it's too much. It's just too much. I know it thinks it's being funny. Anyway, it's the Maximum Rampage Edition.
Oh, why?
Whatever. There isn't even Maximum Extras on it. It's just, you know, it's got Movies Anywhere code, if that matters to anybody. Oh, let's see. 80 for Brady. Speaking of, you know.
Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda again.
All of them. Moreno and Sally Field and actual Tom Brady. Four old ladies got a thing for Tom Brady. And that's
which is also based on the true story, as I understand it, you know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, it's just, it's one of these, you know, old age wish fulfillment things. I just think these actresses deserve something better. Anyway, it's on Blu-ray if you want to see it. Let's see what else we have here. Roland Emmerich, executive produced this. He did not direct it, but it sort of has shades of his sensibilities all over. It's called The Magic Flute.
Mm.
It's got a great cast. F. Murray Abraham and, you know, Asha Banks and, you know, some Amir Wilson. I mean, it's a good solid little cast. Kind of, sort of Harry Potter-esque thing going on here. It's the Mozart All Boys Music School, and there's like the library at the school is some kind of a Stargate that connects with, you know, the magic flute, the Mozart opera, and it becomes like kind of this weird musicalized classical version of Alice in Wonderland or maybe the Chronicles of Narnia. I'm not quite sure which. It's like most things Roland Emmerich has his fingers on, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. But I guess, you know, for certain set that wants its Harry Potter derivation itch scratched, it's meaningful. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you see Jesus Revolution?
I did not.
It's really good. It's really good. Like, I go on radio and I routinely will rip on faith-based films, not because they're faith-based, but because they're all the same.
Yeah. Well, very often. Yeah.
It's a formula. It's like somebody's got a dead-end life as an athlete or a rock star or something. And then somebody close to them says, well, have you found Jesus? And they go, you're some kind of Jesus freak. And then they find Jesus and their life improves and they lose their career, but they gain happiness. End of story. Yeah. And they're all, that's like all of them. That's the trajectory in all of them.
Yeah.
And that's not this. This is a really good movie. They decided to tell a story for a change, which I think is fantastic. So this is
good actors too. Kelsey Grammer, Kimberly Williams.
This is a legit real movie. Yeah, this is from basically the Irwin brothers, and in this case, John Irwin. They've been kind of a force in making the faith based genre more legit, getting real actors, real production value, real money. So this is all about that moment in the '70s when evangelicalism was suddenly infused with a hippie element. And there was a movement of hippies all kind of centered around this one particular preacher. And they merged with the kind of waning moment of old evangelicals. And it created a whole new explosion in the '70s. And it's a really fascinating thing. And there are some very famous evangelists who came out of this. And this is based on the book, written by Greg Laurie, who was one of them. He was like this young kid and he was his thing. And he eventually became a very famous evangelist because he came out of this moment. This was where he kind of found himself. Chuck Smith is the other big pastor that's played by Kelsey Grammer. Chuck Smith was the guy who was trying to figure out a way to sort of make his Christianity relevant to young kids. And suddenly, you know, this crazy, you know, hippie guy comes in and says, hey, man, you know, let's just love everybody. And next thing you know, it's like Flower Children showing up and revivals. And it's a really fascinating moment because I lived through this. This was all here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. It was a big moment here. And I remember those hippies on the side of the road holding up the signs, you know, Jesus loves you. It's like, are you hitchhiking? Nope. Just want everybody to know Jesus loves you.
Okay. It was. This came after it, but it was the same sort of ethos.
Yeah.
That came out of what was that? Yeah, Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah, very much.
Was, so. Yeah, true. You know, kind of a little bit of the Superstar. What is that sort of thing that was going on? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, really, really a quite a good movie, and it's warts and all. You know, it is warts and all. It really these are well rounded characters, and a really fascinating story. Living with Bill Nye.
I really loved that movie.
I did too.
Yeah, it was. I thought it was just lovely. Who is it? It's by way of Kurosawa, if I'm not
mistaken. Yes, it's based on a Kurosawa film.
Yeah, which is actually based on I think a Russian
Ikiru. Is the Kurosawa film it's based on, but it's its own thing. I mean, what I love about this, it was written by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote the novel that Remains of the Day, and you know, Ishiguro himself is a fascinating bridge between these cultures, because he is of Japanese extraction, but raised in England, so he's very British.
Yeah.
So he's the perfect guy. You know, I mean, Remains of the Day, if you look at it, one of my favorite films of all time, it is one of them. It is the most British of British films, written by a Brit of Japanese extraction, adapted by Ruth Parjabvala, who's German, and directed by James Ivory, who's American, and produced by Ismail Merchant, who's Indian. There are no Brits involved in that thing other than the cast.
Yeah.
But it's so British. And Ishiguro is this guy who can look at Ikiru and say, you know what? That very Japanese film is also very English.
Mm-hmm.
And next thing you know, you have this wonderful Bill Nye movie. And it is, I just think it's one of the great performances of last year. And maybe
he was nominated.
He was
lovely, which was wonderful for him to be nominated. He never had a shot. But I thought it was lovely for him to be nominated. It's a beautiful film, too, by the way. This great story about this guy who finds out that he doesn't have long left, and realizes that he hasn't spent much of his life, quote unquote, living, and kind of goes for it. He fixes his sights on doing this one particular thing in this community. I love that setting of London in the like 50s or something like that.
Yeah.
I think the 50s, and so it's like post-war, but it's before the sort of British pop thing. All the men. It's that moment where the men are switching from wearing bowlers to wearing Hamburg and fedoras. But at the beginning of it, everybody's still wearing bowlers, and those really, really wonderful set pieces and conversations. It was just a beautiful film. It was a score that's just absolutely magnificent. I love the score of that film. So Living, check that one out.
Got a steelbook of the Shudder film VHS 99, VHS Goes to Hell. Too many people, they don't even know what VHS is anymore. This is not bad. It's kind of an homage of sorts to a certain kind of VHS slasher film. And the VHS was like the gritty people who could get hold of a VHS camcorder could, make their own movies for the first time at a time when that was just like the most novel thing in the world. And those camcorders were, they were the size of a backpack. I mean, it was ridiculous. But
I go back to the ones where there were two pieces. You had the camera piece, and then that
connected
to the cassette piece, which was wired. And then, of course, somebody had the idea of figured out how to combine those together. It was just this one big ass camera.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, these are five little films all tacked together, and it's an anthology. It's a little bit like Creepshow, but it's low budget, and it's a fun throwback. It really is. So it's, Shudder is is the right home for something like this, and it's on Steelbook, and it's a whole lot of fun. It's good fun. Not so fun, 65 with Adam Driver.
That did not work at all. That hit the wall hard.
Oh man, did it ever. And it's from the writing team who did Quiet Place. Crashing back down to earth here. What, there's something kind of How would I put it? I mean, it's not, it's a little like it's somebody wanted to smash a little bit of Jurassic Park with a little bit of Predator. Mm. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah, a little with maybe a dash of what was it? Charlton Heston. First Planet of the Apes. First Planet. Or the one where he's the Richard Matheson Legends or whatever.
Well, anyway. Let's see. Let's wrap it up here. Let me see. Renfield. How about Renfield?
Man. Look, Nick Cage was having a whole lot of fun playing Dracula. Nicholas Holt as, you know, Renfield. And he gets he's imbued with powers whenever he eats those bugs and then he can go out and he can do basically superhero stuff. So it's a way that you can they figured out a way to create a superhero within the Dracula myth and lore, and they make it. They basically make it a dysfunctional relationship between Renfield and Dracula.
And then
you got you running around, and you all, it's just the police department's all crazy. And look, this movie is so gory.
I didn't see it, but people told me that
it's just so gory. And this is new thing that they can do, that they've been doing in all of the, sort of horror television shows where they can basically blow, an organic, a person, a cow, whatever it is, you can just blow it into all the pieces. They do it on Stranger Things all the time so that, everything is just coated with the bits and pieces. So they do it like 10 times in this movie. I'm like, okay, I get it. You can realistically blow somebody up, but you really only need to do that once, if ever, in a movie. They do it like 10 times in this movie, and it's come on, guys, come on.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and then one other new movie here, and then I'll just take us into some criterions real fast. Guy Ritchie's The Covenant.
Hello?
Jake Gyllenhaal kind of a Gulf War thing, he's got a translator and he's got to save the Afghan translator's life to get him out, and it's a whole brotherhood thing. Not much of a Guy Ritchie movie, to be honest. It doesn't feel like a Guy Ritchie movie. It's not bad. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That was look, Jeff, Jake made Jarhead adaptation of that way back, early in his career back there. So, he already had one of these. So I don't really know why he's there.
Well, so we also, real quickly, from Arrow, we've got a boxed set of, as long as we're talking about VHS, they've got a very strange box set of it's called Arrow, Arrow Videos Open Till 11 p.m. box set. And it's a bunch of VHS kind of 80s era VHS era movies that I guess they have in the library, and they couldn't figure out how to make money off of them. So they all threw them into one box set. It's the Dungeon Master, Dolls, Cellar Dweller, Arena, and Robot Jocks.
And Robot Jocks. I love Robot Jocks and Cellar Dweller. I think I reviewed Robot Jocks back in the day, early 90s, right?
But yeah, they're all thrown together in one box set.
And they make no sense together.
No sense at all. So anyway, really quickly then, Criterion has an unbelievably great set of stuff. First off, we have Medicine for Melancholy, which is Barry Jenkins, amazing debut feature from 2008. Most people have not seen this, but if you want to know where Moonlight came from, this will show you. This is a great directing debut. This is really, it's low budget, but man, it's really poetic, and it's just wonderfully, wonderfully put together. A lot of great extras on here. Audio commentary where he just goes and really lays it on the line. We've also got The Servant, which I recently picked up in 4K from the UK, but a nice Blu-ray from Criterion nonetheless of the Joseph Losey film. From 1963, really kind of a seminal classic, beautiful black and white. Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game on 4K, genius film, amazing movie from 1939, kind of opened up French cinema to the world in the sound era. Really great, tons and tons and tons of extras. You've got to upgrade for this. It's really great in 4K. And then Time Bandits in 4K, Terry Gilliam classic, beautiful lenticular cover, also loaded with extras, really fun stuff. The audio commentary with Gilliam and Michael Palin and John Cleese is fantastic. Really, really great. A lot of fun. And the movie totally holds up because it's not CGI effects. It's all practical effects.
Yep. Terry liked the Bill stuff.
He did. And then lastly, Pasolini 101, which is 9 Pasolini films, not including Solo, very wisely, because that disgusts people. But these are 9 great Pasolini films that establish him really as one of the great Italian visionaries of that moment. A very troubled figure, if you know anything about his life, his death, kind of like the Italian Fassbender in some respects. But the films are Acatone, Mama Roma, Love Meetings, The Gospel According to Matthew, which is really fantastic. It's a Jesus biopic done from a very political perspective. The Hawks and the Sparrows, Oedipus Rex, Teorama, which is wonderful, Porcile, and Medea. So, you know, get your Pasolini on. He's a controversial figure, but really worth checking out. So.
I think Willem Dafoe played him in something.
He did recently.
Abel Ferrara.
All right. Well, we'll be back in a few weeks.
Yeah.
I think I'm looking at your TV back there. You got Godzilla on. Something going on.
That's probably common or something like that. Outstanding.
All right, everybody. See you next time.
Next time.